Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Blind Spot. I'm your host, Jason Pulaski, the blind man. I'd like to say the blind man like I was the only one, but that grammar actually bothers me, so I can't really justify saying it, even though I just did. Whatever. But here I am again. This is episode 6 at long last. I know many people have been waiting. By many, I mean I think 0, but that's not really the point. I just want to do a podcast. I pay Podbean the astronomically crazy sum of $14 a month, you know, and so if I don't do enough episodes, I feel very, very, wasteful economically. Right, that's how I feel. As always, I have no idea what I'm about to talk about. Oh, I do not have a guest today. It's just me, myself, and I, which is 3 words that just mean me. One person. I don't like that. I need more guests, but you can't always find a cool dude in the parking lot of an Applebee's when you need to. Also, it's 2 in the morning, guests are limited unless I'm trying to pull from an international theater, which, I'm not. I haven't done that. It's just me here. Perhaps it's not usual, but, like, I really don't know what I'm going to talk about today. I hope to talk about something so that I can finally put this episode up. I've tried to do it about 1 billion times, and I'm like, oh, it's not good enough. I freak out and delete the thing. So, I mean, you know, there's that, which is not great. I have a friend who is actually an international person. Just because we were speaking of international theater, the international theater, which is just to say, like, you know, places that are not here, where it would be later than 2 a.m., I have a friend who asked me, why does everything on your podcast have to be controversial when I was, like, running through some topics that I was discussing? And, you know, it doesn't. That's why guests help, because they get me off of my own shit. But, like, the reason that I often talk about stuff that one might think of as controversial on my own show is because it's mostly what I'm thinking about. I have some non-controversial ways to occupy my time. I read a lot. For example, right now I'm reading Honor Thy Father by Gay Talese and The Raj Quartet by Paul somebody. Sorry, Paul. I mean, he's probably dead, so it doesn't really matter. But anyway, the point is, like, I read books and stuff, but I find it kind of weird to go off on, like, a 20-minute tangent about a book you haven't read that I've read. I just don't see that would be interesting to people. I mean, I suppose that, like, going off on a 30-minute tangent about how I feel about the Israel-Hamas conflict, or, you know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or Donald Trump, or Joe Biden, or anything, like, you know, that has the potential to be not interesting to anybody either, but at least it's interesting to one person, which is me. Is it who is me? Whatever. At least it's interesting to me. And, like, you know, none of my friends give a fuck what I think about stuff. I get 5 minutes tops to be like, this is what I think about this. And then they're like, that's great, bro. But they don't really mean it. You know what I mean? They don't mean it's great. They mean shut the fuck up. And so, like, I can't really blame them. But it's one of the reasons I have a podcast. Ideally there will be guests. I'm scrambling and scrabbling to get them, I promise, you know. But it's difficult. It's difficult. I'm controversial. And also, it's a sensitive time where, like, you know, where a lot of people do not want to appear on any type of public platform. Even though, like, this public platform is so underground, it might as well be a mausoleum. Wait a minute, that's not underground. Let's just call it a grave. Because nobody is listening, you know. A grave is a fine and private place. Or is that a mind? Or was it both in 2 different poems? I can't remember. Anyway, not the point. Not the point. It is the point. No one will hear this anyway. I tell everybody, like, you can be a guest on the show. No one's gonna listen to it. If anyone's listening to this, I'm, like, shocked. Thank you for listening, by the way. I hope to please and entertain and inform. Let's see, where to begin, though? That's the problem. You know, I begin, and then I feel like I start losing track of my points, and it's really too bad. I've been thinking a lot about Russia and Ukraine. You know, I don't know who follows what how closely. But, you know, the Russians invaded Ukraine 2 years ago. It's coming up on the second anniversary in, I believe, 6 days. The Russians invaded Ukraine because they want to steal it, or eat it up, or annex it, or conquer it, or incorporate it into Russia. They want to make Ukraine cease to exist as an independent entity, although they might continue to make it exist on paper. But much like the times of the Soviet Union, the Russians want a vassal state, and they're fighting to get one. I believe that's a bad thing. I don't want a more powerful Russia, and Ukraine doesn't want to be invaded, you know. So those are the two reasons I think it's bad. I mean, there's more than two. If you can't tell by the accent, I'm an American. The Russians tend to oppose us at every turn. Which isn't surprising. I mean, I expect that. I mean, we usually oppose what they're doing, too, because very often it conflicts with our interests. You know, welcome to geopolitics. So, when Russia invaded Ukraine, what happened was the West, you know, broadly speaking, which means like Europe and Australia and Japan and South Korea and Canada, the U.S., New Zealand, let's see. Couple other countries scattered around, you know, the enlightened democracies with money. That's the West. So, you know, most of those nations decided to help Ukraine. So they put strong economic sanctions on the Russians, you know, to limit their ability to access the global markets and economy. And they've been giving Ukraine weapons and money and humanitarian aid, which is like food and stuff, to have the ability to continue the war. The biggest contributor has been the U.S. By a lot, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me because, you know, we're not European and the Europeans are European and the war is on the continent of Europe. But most European nations, for some reason, seem pretty sure they're not going to be at war with Russia and they're giving money accordingly. It's like, here's $2 billion, here's another $3 billion, you know. And like even when they do give more money, it's weird. So like just recently, the European Union authorized a payment of $50 billion to Ukraine. I don't mean a payment. I mean that's the total cost of the package. But the problem is it's over 4 years. The cost is going to be paid out over 4 years, which is really, really stupid because Ukraine may not exist next year. So it's sort of a way to be cheap, like, oh, good, the Russians conquered the Ukrainians. And now we saved the $35 billion we didn't hand out yet. You know, just give it to them right now. Except that the Europeans are fucking cheap, you know, and like, cheap and, what's the word I want? Not apathetic, they're short-sighted and like, I'll just go with dumb. You know, the Europeans just kind of tra-la-la these days. It's like, you know, at some point after 1945, they said, like, you know, we don't want to be a part of history anymore. We're just going to put our feet up and hang out. And that's what they've done. Like, what the Europeans don't do is remarkable. They're not poor. They're a huge, rich continent. They don't do anything. Just fuck around with themselves. Talk about our isolation, you know? Sorry. So anyway, but recently, you know, there is a wing in the Republican Party, a wing, by a wing, I mean a section or a faction, you know, that has decided that we should no longer aid Ukraine. Oh, see, this is what I hate. I'm sorry. I sort of messed up because I was telling a story. And I got sidetracked by yelling about the Europeans. And then I kind of lost my place in the story. So anyway, let me just hop back. So when the invasion started, the West and her close allies, so there are some non-Western countries who are tightly bound up with the West in, like, economy and like, I don't know, security agreements and, like, kind of, I don't want to use the word friendship, but let's just say, like, long-term association. You know, those groups have also contributed to aiding Ukraine. Those countries, sorry. And, like, some other countries haven't. For example, much of the Third World or the Global South, whichever term you're more comfortable with, the poor countries in South America or Africa. That's a redundancy. I could have just said Africa minus South Africa, which may be poor, too. But anyway, like, you know, the poor countries, I guess this is just a redundancy everywhere. Okay, so South America and Africa, you know, Central America, these, like, previously Soviet-affiliated states, like, are not helping Ukraine. They don't really care. Or they say they don't, I mean, they just don't care. They just have a different perspective on it, which is like, fuck it. We don't care. And like, you know, they have a bunch of anti-American governments, you know, and so like things that America does, they don't want to do. And so that includes helping Ukraine. I don't really get the logic or care to understand it myself. You know, I'm ready to write them off. Like, I don't, I mean, the South Americans have been dysfunctional for 80 years, and the Africans have been dysfunctional for 500. So, like, when they make poor decisions, it's no surprise to me. You know, and I mean, also, you know, I think the other reason that, hang on, let me just finish one point before I move on to the other. So the other group that are not aiding Ukraine are the, like, sort of Russian-allied countries. They aren't just kind of reflexively anti-American because of stuff that happened before. So, for example, let's think of a country. In South America, let's say, okay, yeah, Venezuela is an anti-American country. Like, they oppose us kind of on principle. You know, they were communist aligned for a long time, and when they're not communist, they're like very, very red socialists. By red, I mean extreme socialists. I mean, it's amazing to say that because their economy is so horrible, but that's like what they were trying to do. And so a country like Venezuela will oppose the things we do just because we do them, usually. You know, but then there's a kind, but it also doesn't matter because who cares what Venezuela does? Like, Venezuela is never going to move the needle on the world stage, probably. You know, nothing they do is really going to matter, so their opposition doesn't really matter. It kind of matters when 20 or 30 countries as powerful as Venezuela hang together in opposition. Like, it would be better if all the countries not helping Ukraine were helping Ukraine. But they aren't. But anyway, so there's that group, but there's also a group that doesn't help Ukraine because they are allies of Russia, or at least, like, not just kind of sort of opposed to what the U.S. does, but they are, like, ideological strong enemies of America, both for reasons of ideology. Oh, I almost just spat on the floor to clear my throat until I realized I'm not in my own house. It's not just for reasons of ideology, but for reasons of practicality. So, like, the Chinese, for example, aid the Russians and oppose us because, you know, like, because we're basically in the Cold War with China. And the Iranians do the same thing because, you know, we oppose basically everything Iran does. So when we do something, Iran reflexively opposes it. And, like, you know, because Russia is the most active enemy of the United States right now, it's kind of a moth to a flame for all our other enemies. So the people who don't like us are using this opportunity to back the Russians because we don't like what the Russians are doing. And also, like, what the Russians are doing is a war of conquest, and many other nations who don't like us want to launch wars of conquest of their own. Like Taiwan, or like China wants to invade Taiwan, for example. I mean, Iran would certainly, like, invade Iraq if it thought it could get away with it. So you see, like, there are plenty of nations who want a different world order, a world order where you are allowed to go conquer your neighbor or your neighbor's neighbor or both. Which is, like, which should be no surprise to anybody, but apparently was a huge surprise to a lot of people. So that's the opposition. Unfortunately, you know, what's now, okay, now I can continue. Okay. So that was 2 years ago. The sanctions we imposed kind of worked, but they didn't really work. Also, I mean, part of the reason they didn't really work is because they were built badly. I mean, amazingly enough, like, so as this war started, Russia invaded Ukraine, as this started, at the same time the Europeans were, like, going up on the stages in diplomatic conferences and lamenting what a horrible thing this was that had happened, and saying how it can't happen and we can't let it happen and we're going to stop it. At the same time they were doing that, they were also still buying Russian energy, like oil and natural gas. I mean, like, in huge quantities. Like, Germany was literally heating its homes in the winter of 22, and probably in 23 as well, the next year, with Russian energy at the same time as it was putting sanctions on Russia and giving Ukraine some money. which is insane because that's like buying Russian energy is simply funding the Russian war effort. You know, you figure they would have stopped immediately, those Europeans, and that they did not, you know, just shows how much they care about it, which is not as much as they should. I mean, and by the way, like, look, you know, I don't expect very much of the Europeans. Their major achievement after World War II was to stop killing each other, which they have mostly done. And, you know, kudos to them for that. It only took them 1,000 years. But, you know, the problem is that, like, after that, like, they don't do much. They don't take moral stance. They take many moral stances, but never back them. So, like, you know, when they had a problem with Mr. Gaddafi's conduct in Libya back in 2011, their solution to that problem was to beg us to help them, which we did. And, you know, so, like, that's standard European policy, is to, like, do nothing and complain a lot and then hope we do something. And, like, you know, they've gotten a little bit better since this war started, but still bad. And so even as this war began and continued, the Europeans were still buying, not every country, by the way, just many of them, were still buying Russian energy, which is insanity, which is just absolute insanity. It would have been like if France was giving Germany money for oil and getting oil in exchange, even as Germany was invading Spain or something. But it's mind-boggling. It's like you're paying a guy who's clearly preparing a campaign of conquest, because if Russia takes Ukraine, I don't think they're going to stop with the Ukrainians. So, I mean, that type of short-sighted shit is just amazing to me. But it's worse than that. So it's not just the European inconsistency that made the sanctions not work as well as they could. I don't know if everybody knows what sanctions mean, so in case you've been listening and don't, sanctions is just a fancy term for, like, economic boycotts or, like quarantines or, like, I don't know, smaller words, or, like, a sanction is, like, we're not going to do any business with you anymore, we're not going to trade with you, and, like, we're not going to do business with people who do business with you or trade with you either. So it's like, hey, you know, don't trade with Russia or we won't trade with you. We've done things like remove the Russians from a global banking system. We've done a lot of stuff. We've tried pretty hard to isolate them. But the other reason, in addition to European that it hasn't worked, is that, like, the Russians have their collection of allies. They have the Iranians, they have the North Koreans, they have the Chinese, they have some South American countries, they have India, which still buys Russian oil. You know, India has been traditionally kind of neutral, tilt this way, tilt that way, as is best for India. I don't expect anything more, by the way. You know, so like, the thing is, you may hear these countries and think, oh, so what, the North Koreans or the Iranians, who cares? You know, they're not rich. But, like, you add them up, and then you're suddenly dealing with a network that's able to sustain Russia. And that network will do that because they like that Russia is invading Ukraine, because it's distracting Europe and America, and poking them in the eye, so to speak. You know, it's a good way to show that they don't give a fuck what we say about anything. Sorry, give a fuck what we say about anything. And so, like, those countries have given Russia enough business and trade and support to counteract the sanctions. Not completely. Like, Russia would still vastly prefer to have full access to the global economy, but enough. Russia's still getting some computer chips and still getting some, like, you know, parts to make missiles with, and, like, has made a deal, for example, for the North Koreans to provide Russia with artillery shells, something it very much needs, because this is largely an artillery... I apologize for my muddy mouthedness. I feel like I'm slurring. But anyway, it's largely an artillery war. Ah, my God, it is largely an artillery war at this point. Like, so huge amounts of artillery shells are needed by both sides, and the North Koreans, waiting for a huge war with South Korea, have plenty of artillery shells, and they're giving some to the Russians, or selling them to them, not the point. Either way, it doesn't matter. So you see, like, Russia is not as isolated as we wish it would be, because it still has some friends or some associates that'll help. Now I'm up to date. The war has gone fairly well for Russia, in that they haven't lost it. They've taken about 20% of Ukraine's territory, and are doing decently on the battlefield. Like, they're making more gains recently. There's a city called Avdiivka. I'm probably not pronouncing that right, but it's a city in Ukraine, and Russia is about to take it. You know, the Ukrainians are probably going to retreat to, like, a big coal plant. You know, they've done this before, but in a month, they'll probably take the city. The Russians, I mean. So, like, the Russians are doing okay. They're going slower than they wanted, but a war is not a race. And the Ukrainians are holding out because of Western aid. We give them money and we give them weapons, and it's enough for them to last in this war. Like, if we'd given them nothing, it would be over by now. The Russians would have won already. But because we give the Ukrainians aid and money, it's enough for the Ukrainians to kind of fight the Russians to what is sort of a draw. I mean, not a draw exactly. It's never a draw when an enemy country has a beachhead in your own country, but they have not lost. Ukraine has not lost. That's the best way to look at it. Okay. So in December, our aid to Ukraine ran out. The aid packages we'd given them, which is a huge number, it's about $75 to $85 billion in total. It's a combination of cash, weapons, you know, like food, a whole bunch of stuff. A lot of weapons and some money and like some loans, just a whole bunch of shit. So that package ran out in December, and there is a wing of the Republican Party that has decided to not fund Ukraine anymore. They don't want to do it. Why they don't want to do it is complicated. A few of them don't want to do it because they don't think it's our business exactly. You know, they would say, it's too bad what Russia is doing in Ukraine, but, you know, like, we have problems here at home that we should deal with, and, like, Ukraine's shit isn't really our problem, and, like, the Europeans should deal with it instead of us. It's really a European problem, and, like, you know, we have this and that and the other thing going on over here, and we're not going to do it anymore. We've already given them $75 billion. I don't like how the money is accounted for. Maybe they'll lose. There's plenty of reasons that like, a couple of these Republicans have for not supporting Ukraine. But most of them don't support Ukraine because Donald Trump goes out in public and says it's a stupid thing to support. And many people in the Republican Party are Donald Trump's bitches these days, and they'll do whatever he says because they're afraid of him and afraid of his voters, and they want to keep their jobs. It's just political cowardice, which is not uncommon in politicians. It's just more common in the Republican Party right now than is usual in our country. Many of them have, in essence, bent the knee to Donald Trump. You know, which disgusts me. Because Donald Trump attempted a coup, which is an illegal government takeover. I'm going to say this every episode of this show. And one of these days, I might even spend an hour explaining how. I'm sure everybody will enjoy that. Anyway, so it's about, I don't know, half of the Republicans in the House of Representatives and maybe a third of the Republicans in the Senate feel this way. I don't even know if they feel this way. This is just what they're doing because they're a bunch of fucking bitch-ass cowards, you know? And, like, So what's just happened is, a couple months ago, the Republicans, in a move of political savvy, said that what they wanted in exchange for supporting Ukraine with aid was a strong border security bill. I've talked about this on the show before. If you're a regular listener, you know, I've talked about this before. So what happened was the Republicans said, listen, you Democrats want to aid Ukraine, and so do we. But there is a huge problem at our southern border, which is true. That problem is that every month about 300,000 illegal immigrants come across the border and make contact with Border Patrol. Our immigration laws are so fucked up that what we usually do when we run into those people is we deport some of them, but most of them, I mean at least half and probably more, but if it's 40%, it's still hugely gross and fucked up. We allow to come into the country and move wherever they want in it, and we say to them, listen, you have a hearing to determine whether you'll be deported, and that hearing is in 4 years, or that hearing is in 5 or 6 or 3 years. So in that amount of time, here's your court date, come on in like 2028, and we'll decide whether we're going to kick you out. Believe it or not, most of those people don't show up to those court dates. The system is broken, and it's resulting in a huge, huge problem where what's happening is we're creating an underclass of illegal immigrants. I am not down with that. I don't want that to happen. What I would like is for the amount of illegal immigrants that cross our southern border to go below 10,000 a month. I want that number at zero. I'm just a realist and understand that won't happen. But 300,000 a month is madness, and I want that to stop. I am as hawkish as anybody can be on illegal immigration. I would deport every single illegal immigrant who's here right now if I could find them all easily enough. The reason I'm against doing that is because I can't do it. It's impossible to do. It'll cost us a shitload of money, and we'll still not be able to do it. It'll be damaging to society. There's reasons not to do it, but none of those reasons have to do with the people who snuck in here without our permission and stay here that way. I want them out. I want them all out, you know? And I want the ones coming over like that next month out too. Fuck that. I'm not interested. If you'd like to come to this country, you do it the right way or not at all. Period. Period. Now, there are a few exceptions. For example, Joe Biden, who is the president, just in case you didn't know, I'm not sure of your level of political engagement. Mr. Biden just said recently that we will not be deporting people to Palestine right now, to the Gaza Strip. Well, I mean, good, because that's a slaughterhouse, and we shouldn't do that. Deporting people to certain other countries that are literally at war, yeah, I'm cool with not doing that, that's fine, they can stay until the war is over. But, you know, the day that war in Gaza stops, send them fucking back, then the war is over. You know, they came here illegally, and now it's safe to go back, so go back. So that's how I feel about that. Send them home. If you came here illegally, I want you deported. Sorry. Your kids can stay, though, if you had them here and they have citizenship. I'm cool with that. So, you accomplished something. So the Republicans wanted a border security bill. And the Republicans, kind of being shiesty, I think it's shiesty, they said, listen, here's the ask. We want a border security bill, and in exchange for that border security bill, we will support aiding Ukraine. Also Israel and Taiwan. Not important right now. But then they got their border security bill. The Democrats said, okay, fine, we really want to aid Ukraine. And also, the illegal immigrants, the hordes and hordes of them, that are now making their way into traditionally Democratic states and cities like New York City and Chicago, you know, so the state of Illinois and the state of New York, and, Massachusetts, I mean, many other blue states. Blue states means like Democratic-leaning, left-leaning states that have traditionally said, we welcome all illegal immigrants. We're not going to ask you what your immigration status is. We're going to give you social benefits, la, 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 la. Like, you know, on and on. Like, now that we have a huge, huge influx of illegal immigration, you know, it's millions and millions of people every year. I mean, estimates say that 8 million people have come into this country since Biden took office illegally. And it was already bad before Biden got here. It was already a major problem. It's been a major problem for 15, 20 years. So, but now it's even worse. And now what's happening is more and more illegal immigrants are just cruising into the interior of the country, all the way to the Northeast. So, like, you know, all the way to New Hampshire and Maine and Massachusetts, Connecticut, everywhere. So these traditionally Democratic states and cities, which have been very open to illegal immigrants when there were, like, you know, 8 or 9 coming in a month, are now, pardon me, hang on, I have to burp and clarify something. Thank you. 8 or 9, by the way, is a metaphor. But, like, you know, several years ago, the amount of illegal immigration was manageable in these cities and states. Sure, it cost the taxpayers more money, but, like, not a shitload of money. And, like, it didn't strain social services as it is now. Because, see, what we're doing now is spending money on people who aren't our people, who've come here with their hands out. Oh, I suppose to be accurate, it's not completely true. Most of these illegal immigrants want to work here, but I don't care. Because if we let them work here, it's just doubling down on the mistake that we made when they got in the first place. So anyway, listen, so what's happening now is both because the Democrats really, really want to aid Ukraine, as they should. It's super important to help the Ukrainians. But also because illegal immigration and, like, hordes and hordes of asylum seekers who get to wait for their asylum claims to be vetted in this country while they wait are becoming an increasing political liability to Democrats Thank God, you know. So, like, the thing is, these people who've come from South and Central America, and by the way, every other continent, because they fly to South America and then walk here, these people have strained social services enough that it's pissed off, like, normal, politically uninvolved people. Because, you know, there's, like, 80, you know, Guatemalans in a hotel now, or whatever, or, like, sleeping on the street, or, like, begging for construction jobs, whatever. It's, like, you know, it's straining city budgets and state budgets and, like, you know, state and city and town services and, like, welfare benefits and all that other shit. So, anyway, some Democrats in certain states and cities are like, shit, this is bad for us politically now, too, because, like, the Republicans have been beating the drum of the border for 20 years, saying, like, no more illegal immigration, you know. Some of their appeals are racist. I mean, but they are like, very hawkish on the border. And, like, that hawkishness seemed like overkill when there were only, like, a couple illegal immigrants in blue cities and states, because they figured, fuck it, whatever, it's just a rounding error, we don't care. But now that it's not a rounding error, now that it's a lot, they do care. It's politically dangerous now for them to say, hey, we love this illegal immigration, give us some more, which is what the default is, which is what the status quo is. So, because of those two factors, the politics of the situation being worse for Democrats now, and the urgent need to aid Ukraine, the Democrats said, okay, we will negotiate with you on border security, which is code for, like, keep immigrants out, illegal immigrants, not lawful immigrants. It's a whole different, unrelated issue. Entirely unrelated. I have my hands as far apart as I can make them go right now, like I have wings. That's how unrelated these things are. I love illegal immigration. You know, in the year, let me see, in the year 2022, we created 1 million new citizens. Good. I hope we create just as many in 2023. I mean, for that year, I hope it's just as high, and just as many this year. I would even double it. But that's not the point, and I don't want to get sidetracked. So, the Republicans, while being a little shiesty but very politically sharp, got what they wanted on Ukraine. They got Ukraine aid. Now, I'm sorry. They got the border security bill they wanted. It was a good bill. I looked it up. I was really excited it was going to pass. And then what happened is that treasonous, seditious son of a bitch, Donald Trump, came out in public and said, don't vote for that bill because I would like to campaign on the southern border being out of control, because it'll help me win the presidency, so kill the bill. And his little bitches in the House did exactly that. They said it's dead on arrival. Also, the Senate killed it. I mean, like, many of these people just before Trump came out were very pleased and said so that they were getting a border security bill, and then when it came out, Trump killed it. So then what happened is even crazier. The Ukraine aid bill was introduced without the illegal immigration part in the Senate. And the Republicans said, hey, we want border security elements in this bill. Keep in mind, like, literally 2 or 3 days earlier, they had just killed that very thing. Like, that very thing they said they wanted 2 days later existed 2 days before and they'd killed it. So then they said, we want border security elements in this bill. They did not get any of those elements in that new bill, and then they voted for it anyway. So it's a whole big, like, 3 or 4 month process where they started with one thing, rejected it because it did not have a second thing involved in it, used good political tactics to get that second thing involved, and then when they had gotten it, they said, fuck it, we don't want it anymore, except, wait a minute, we still do, but then voted for the original bill they had not wanted to vote for all those months ago anyway, without the thing they just spent all this time getting. It's insane. And nobody would believe it if it hadn't happened. And so now that Ukraine aid bill has gone to the House of Representatives, where apparent Trump lackey, Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has said it's dead on arrival. However, many people in the House of Representatives, many Republicans, I'm sorry that I'm not, like, speaking perfectly here, it's a little difficult. Many Republicans in the House still want to aid Ukraine. I mean, the House is divided pretty close. The Republicans have a majority of, I believe, I'm trying to do math, sorry, 6 or 7. You know, if everybody's there, the Republicans have a majority of 6 or 7. And, so that means that if every Republican sticks together, they have a majority to pass or, like, kill things. But if every Republican does not stick together, they don't. So let's just say a quarter to half of the Republicans in the House want to vote for aiding Ukraine. That means, you know, giving it more money and more weapons and stuff. And 90% of Democrats want that. So that's about two-thirds to three-quarters of the whole House. So it's like 315 to 380 people out of 435 people. That's plenty of votes to get that bill through. So there are ways of getting around what Speaker Johnson will or won't do to bring bills to the floor anyway. There's something called a discharge petition, where if two-thirds of Congress people want a bill to be on the floor and they all sign a piece of paper, that bill can move to the floor without the Speaker's consent. But that makes the Speaker look like a piece of shit, because it looks like he's out of control and can't, and like, and nobody, it undermines his power, because the whole chamber is going around him. So if a discharge position looks likely to pass, it's possible that it will. I mean, I'm sorry, it's possible that the Speaker of the House will simply bring the bill to the floor anyway to avoid the appearance or the reality of him just not being relevant to the process. It's like either, you know, fucking run out in front of the herd or fucking get trampled or something. It's not a perfect metaphor. In case you don't understand why we should help Ukraine, there's a couple of different reasons, and I want to go through them because I feel like some people, you know, I don't know what everybody knows. I don't know who knows what. And so, like, I feel like some people don't know a lot of shit, or, like, have been thinking about this in a different way. So, listen, if you are not just a person who is reflexively agreeing with everything Donald Trump says, because those type of people I can't argue with. I could, but it's pointless. It's like arguing with communists is just not worthwhile, because they don't hold their position from an ideology, they hold it from dogmatism. So listen, like, if you are a person who doesn't think that we should be helping Ukraine, and by the way, it's a huge package that we want to give them like $60 or $70 billion right now, which is a ton of money. With that much money, we could certainly secure the southern border and stop these like millions of illegal immigrants from walking into the country. I mean, or we could certainly overhaul all our poorest schools with that money, or we could replace every lead water pipe in the country with one that wasn't, or we could build 100 new national hospitals in underserved areas, or replace the entire broadband network to a faster nationalized one. I mean, with $70 billion, we could do a lot of shit. But the reason that we should give that money to Ukraine is this. Okay, look, if you're a person who opposes that because you don't think it's our problem, it is our problem. It's not our problem this month or next month or this year, probably, whether or not Russia takes Ukraine. It's not. If Russia took Ukraine right now, American life would basically go on as before. You know, too bad, so sad for the Ukrainians, but like, we wouldn't lose any money out of it. Taxes wouldn't go up, prices of goods wouldn't go up. You know, I mean, if we'd wanted to, for example, we could have been selling the Russians weapons instead. You know, hey, you have an invasion going on. I hear you're running a little short artillery shells. We got you, dog. You know, we could have done that if we wanted. So I'm saying, if we were totally cold-blooded, this war could have had advantages to us. We could have just said, fuck it, and helped the Russians. But the problem is this. Well, there's a couple problems. First of all, I want to address the easy part. So I feel like some of you don't want to help Ukraine because you see the kind of lukewarm, kind of like confused, like, you know, apathetic, like sleepy, groggy, like, you know, pathetic way Europe is helping Ukraine. In that, like, you know, here's $1 billion, here's like $4 billion, you know, like, we're going to help, here's another, like, whatever, like, you know, here's $50 billion over 4 years, even though you're in a war for your existence that might end in 8 months, but whatever, you know, it's all kind of like, meh. It's like, you know, the Europeans, like, are reluctant to give tanks, like, they, like, won't do anything unless America does it first. Like, the Europeans, for example, promised Ukraine 1 million artillery shells by, you know, March of this year. But, like, won't manufacture those things. They won't manufacture the artillery. Like, they just don't do it. And, like, they won't build a new factory to do it, and they won't order one of their own factories to do it. I mean, okay. And they won't pay enough money. Like, see, there's a difference between what Europe can do and what Europe is doing. To be really clear here, Europe isn't some shithole third world country, or a group of them, I'm saying. Europe is not poor like that. Europe is one of the richest areas in this world. I mean, it's on par with the United States. I mean, some sections are even richer, but it's on par with us. They are the most developed nations in the world, except for a couple other ones, but they're in that group. The Europeans are rich and like stable and like, you know, there's no, but they don't. So when they say that we're not going to give money to Ukraine, they don't mean they can't do it. They mean they won't do it, which is a hugely different thing. It's one thing to say Honduras cannot give Ukraine $190 billion. I don't even think Honduras has that. You know, they'd have to like sell half their country to raise that money. But the Europeans have plenty of money and they can borrow money too. So when they don't help Ukraine, it's because they don't want to. It's like when the Europeans don't give Ukraine 2 million artillery shells and won't make them, that's a bunch of fucking choices those nations made not to do. At the same time they make that choice, they yell at us like, hey, you Americans, go give Ukraine 2 million artillery shells. You know, even though the war isn't on our continent. Like, there's a very decent argument to be made that this is not our business before it's European business. Now, but I mean, the argument is wrong, but it's convincing on the face, on its face. I also have to point out that even as this war was going on, the Europeans were still buying heat energy, energy to heat their homes and power their shit from Russia. They were going, this war is wrong, but we'd like $1 billion more in oil, please. Instead of just being like, fuck it, we don't want it anymore. There's other places to buy energy. The Saudis sell oil. We sell, the Americans sell oil and natural gas, you know. And in fairness, the Europeans have gotten better on that. But I'm not sure that the Europeans still aren't buying a little bit of Russian oil. It wouldn't surprise me. Which is crazy, but that's what's happening. So you can easily sit here as an American and go, hang on, wait a minute. The Europeans say this Ukraine invasion's wrong, but they're still buying Russian oil. And at the same time the Europeans are buying Russian oil, you want us to turn around and give these guys another $70 billion? You fucking crazy? And I hear you. I hear you. You know, I mean, like, listen, the Europeans regularly disappoint me as a people, too. It's not, I understand. I mean, the Europeans are disappointing people. I'm very glad that they made the European Union with our fucking insistence, by the way. That was our part of our problem. We prodded that into existence, too. But I'm very glad they did that. I'm very glad, even though we you know, encouraged them to do it, they still did it themselves. I'm very glad they did that. I'm very glad that as a continent, they've stopped attacking one another in a series of endless wars. That's very good. I'm very glad the rule of law applies in Europe. I'm pleased that their stances on gay marriage, for example, and their taking in of refugees, and their stable democratic systems, and the fact that the rule of law generally applies to Europe. To European Union countries and their tight allies like the Swiss, you know, or the British, you know, who are not European Union members, but who are, like, in that same general kind of, like, ideological block. So, I don't want to make it sound like I don't like the Europeans. They are good people in general. They've done good things. But they're also, lazy isn't the word I want. They're also, I don't know what the word I want is, but their thing is, like, if the U.S. is going to do it, we're not going to do it. Like, we're going to let the Americans do most of this and just bitch them out when we don't like what they're doing. And that's what they do. I understand why people watching that get upset. Like, if you see the Europeans acting with less vigor and will to deal with the situation on their own continent, and then at the same time you see them expecting us to do it, yes, that angers me too. Believe me. I'm pretty pissed. You know, I mean, like, 1/3 of NATO countries aren't even spending 2% of gross domestic product on their militaries. And 2%, by the way, isn't even high enough. They should really be spending 3.5% like we do, because there's a war on their continent and they might have to fight soon. So it's not about, like, I don't care what's fair. I don't care about the size of their GDPs. I don't care how much money fucking Spain has. If you want NATO membership, spend money. Or get the fuck out. I know we can't kick NATO members out, but listen, I'm not defending. Okay, I'm sorry. Hang on. The NATO countries that don't spend enough money on their militaries are laggards and dragalongs. I am not in this situation. We did not extend them NATO membership for our looks or to trumpet our moral virtue. That's not what this is. If you don't want to participate in your own defense, don't think that we'll do it for you. Like, we want you spending money just like we are so that we think you're pulling your weight too. You know, you're already some little ass country we don't even need. We could leave you out in the cold, no problem. Like, any one of these little tiny... We don't need fucking Sweden and NATO, really. I mean, I'd rather Sweden and NATO. And Sweden actually spends a lot of money on its military. But what I'm saying is that, like, you know, pull your weight. Like, show us that you are a useful member of this alliance. Or you make me question why we invited you into it in the first place. You are not, you European countries in NATO are not simply supposed to be flypaper to catch a war for us, which is what you are when you don't spend money. Spend 3%, so at least I know you're trying as hard as we are to defend yourselves. Thank you. But it's an imperfect world, and so sometimes that does not happen. But we will defend them anyway because the alternative is worse, which is leaving them open to Russian predation and attack. Now, I need to talk to you about why it's worse, because I have just outlined the case, I think, pretty well for why many Americans are frustrated. So, here's the deal. I know the Europeans are disappointing, I agree with you, but the problem is that if Russia wins this war and conquers Ukraine, your defense cannot be, well, the Europeans wouldn't help, so we didn't help either. Because it doesn't affect the ultimate outcome in the situation, which is that Russia conquered Ukraine. And now, Russia, having conquered Ukraine, if that happens, will look around at the other non-NATO allied countries, the ones that are not protected by strong defense treaties with strong countries. And the Russians will say to themselves, hey, look, despite the entire efforts of the West, we still conquered Ukraine. It's going to be much easier than that to conquer a small little country like Moldova. If they couldn't stop us in Ukraine, they won't stop us when we take Moldova, and then they will do that, because why wouldn't you? You know, why not? Why not? Like, so the Russians are going to eat up all these little non-allied, non-aligned NATO countries. And that will make the Russians stronger. I know people want to make jokes about how the Russians are weak and how they just drink themselves to death and how their army is second rate and shit, but they're not fighting first rate armies in Ukraine and Moldova. They don't need a first rate army to take over third rate countries. And they will. If we let them. And the problem is, if the Russians take Ukraine and then they take three or four little non-allied countries, little weak countries that they can take, then there's no incentive for them not to continue. It'll be so tempting for them to fuck with us in NATO. It'll be tempting for them to attack Poland or Estonia, because maybe they think America won't help, or maybe they think whatever, but it doesn't matter, because once that happens, it's World War III. And if you don't want World War III, you should want to stop it right now. Listen, no historical parallel is really useful. To just say, oh, Vladimir Putin is Hitler, or even like Donald Trump is Hitler, those are all wrong statements. Vladimir Putin is Stalin. No, not really. Oh, like, you know, Vladimir Putin is Genghis Khan. No. None of these are really useful. Every situation is unique. So Vladimir Putin is just Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump is Donald Trump. Comparing them to like people who are not those people is satisfying emotionally, but usually not a useful thing to do. But the thing is, we have learned from history this thing. And what we've learned is it's usually best to stop a dictator with dreams of world conquest, or if not world conquest, say continent-wide conquest, earlier rather than later. If we think a guy is nuts and just going on an expansionary war, you know, path of like, we're going to take this country, and then this country, and then that country, and then this country, and then these nine other countries, you know, it's better to fucking stop him now than stop him in 3 years, because in 3 years, he's going to have more land. If Russia takes Ukraine, it will be swollen with natural and human resources more than it has now, and defeating Russia will be harder later than it will be right now. If we whack Russia in the head right now by preventing them from taking Ukraine, we nip this shit in the bud right now. The thing is, if you people think that if Russia takes Ukraine and Moldova and a couple other countries, if you think we're not going to have to deal with it later, you're not thinking well. We are going to have to deal with it later. It's going to beat its chest and fucking yell a bunch of anti-American shit, and it's going to push, and it's going to push, and it's going to push until we get into a war, because that's what the Russians do. They're the same damn people they were 50 years ago. I don't know how you people don't see that, you people who oppose aid in Ukraine now. And by the way, if God gave us an opportunity to hurt the Russians without losing one man or woman from our armed forces, God would have given us an opportunity that looks an awful lot like this one. This is a damn near perfect opportunity to fuck these people up, and all it costs us is money. And we can borrow at low rates of interest right now. It is totally worth doing this. It is a anti-Russian person's wet dream. I know, because I'm coming. You know, like, so the fact that we're even considering not doing this is insanity. There is no upside to not doing this. There are only downsides. You're worried about $100 billion. We spend that all the time on bullshit, on stupid things. Like, then we certainly could cut from our huge ass budget every year. Like, you know, but this is a golden opportunity that we should take. And it is stupid not to take it. I mean, I don't even mean morally. Like, listen, you know, I think the Russians are bad. I don't want to say that every single Russian is a bad person, so I won't. But I think the states the Russian people continually create for themselves are evil states. And the Russian people themselves enable that evil. Now, you listen. I understand that you saw a lot in the popular press about how, oh, this Russian guy opposes the invasion of Ukraine and that Russian lady does, and these 4,000 Russians left because it's an unsafe political environment for them, and these 27 Russians got arrested, and yada, yada, yada. But listen, you know, if the Russians win in Ukraine... I'm sorry, I just heard cowbells out my window. I got distracted. I don't know what the hell that is. You hear that? Wow, I think those are coyotes. I don't know if you can hear that or not, but that's wild. I hear fucking coyotes yipping outside. A whole pack of them. You hear that? I'm going to move this microphone. That's a wild sound. Hang on. I want to see if you can hear this. Why, listen. Wow. That is some crazy shit. Wow, they're all hot and bothered over there. I remember... Man, that's crazy. That's crazy. I haven't heard coyotes like that since I was in Colorado. Anyway. I'm sorry. Where was I? Oh, no. Oh, you goddamn coyotes got me distracted. Motherfucker. This is what I hate about having no guest. I hate it. I hate it so much. But, you know, so... The bottom line is that stopping Russia now is hugely better for the United States. I know where I was now. Okay, now, I understand, I'm not just talking about moral arguments. Like, listen, I don't want to say that every Russian person is a bad person, so I won't. But the Russian people, for 500 or 400 years, have a track record of creating evil states. And they then enable those states to work by participating in the mechanisms that allow those states to do the things they do. Such as the KGB and the army. And even, like, you know... Even the people who, like, you know, spend the money of this state. It's not just soldiers. It's bankers and it's lawyers and all the other mechanisms of state power that exist. So, look, the Russian people have created yet another evil state with their President Putin. This modern version of Russia is just the Soviet Union, but smaller and weaker and not communist. But otherwise, it's the same fucking thing. So there's a moral case to be made that the Russians are a bad people, by which I mean the state they've made, not every single Russian, but the Russians have created another evil state. And strictly on moral grounds, it's worth opposing them. And that's enough for me. That would be just enough for me. But there are other reasons. There are practical reasons. The Russians fuck with us whenever possible, whenever they can. And if we fuck with them harder right now, they won't be able to do that for a long time. You know, if I had my way, I would break... when the Cold War stopped and ended, we should have broken the Russians up into 20 little countries. But we didn't do that. But we can bleed the Russians right now without losing one soldier. All we have to do is give the Ukrainians money, because the Ukrainians are willing to die to fight Russia. And every Russian that dies is good for us. It makes Russia weaker. Every $1 billion Russia spends on this war is good for us, because it's $1 billion they don't have to spend fucking with us. It's a perfect opportunity to weaken Russia, which is good for us Even if you're like, even if you have the morality of Ted Bundy, it's good for us. Because hurting Russia expands our ability to do what we want. Because they won't be around to stop us. They'll be less capable of fucking with us. It's the easiest shit. A child should be able to understand it. And that some of you people don't understand it is simply mind-boggling to me. I mean, to hop around back to the illegal immigrant thing, I understand that some of you idiots just think it's a humanitarian issue. It's like, listen, this guy walked here from Venezuela, and Venezuela is a bad country. So let's just let him stay here because, you know, because Venezuela sucks. I get that that's how you feel. And I fucking, despite the mockery, I applaud your humanitarianism. I just don't agree with it. I don't want to spend the money on that shit. I don't want that guy to just be able to walk in here because his country sucks. Because you know who's responsible for the condition of Venezuelans? I mean, oh, I'm so angry. I'm sorry. The people of Venezuela are the ones responsible for that fucking country being the way it is. They have huge oil reserves. They are one of the top five oil producers in the entire world, potentially. They have the oil. They're just so stupid they can't drill for it. Because they put these weird communist governments in power that fuck everything up. And if that's what they keep choosing to do, then let them do it. It is not our obligation to take your people because you fucked your country up. But anyway, I understand that there are people who disagree with me. They say it is our moral obligation to do that. It's the right thing to do. Let's take in 18 million people who have built themselves countries that fuck them over. Because, oh, you know, they're not responsible for that. And even if they are, who cares? Let's just take them in. Let's give them a place that's not violent and that's safe. And where they can get educated and where their children are safe. And where there's food. You know, and I get that. And I am not against that as much as I am against this other thing. Look. I understand the humanitarian case that's made for these illegal immigrants. I don't agree with it, but I understand it, and I understand it's a case made on principles. I am not saying that that's short-sighted, or stupid, or evil, or wrong, or really against American interests. I disagree with it, but I think, you know, it's a democracy, and everybody has a right to their opinion, and I am not so mad at the people who disagree with me on illegal immigration and asylum seekers. You know, hippies are hippies, I suppose. But this other thing is different. Because, look, isolationism never works for us. We get dragged into shit. It always happens. We tried isolating ourselves from Europe in World War I. And the Europeans just couldn't help it and went into a bloodbath that got so bad it dragged us in. And then we tried again to isolate ourselves after World War I, and once again, the Europeans could not help themselves and got into a second war. And we then, because Japan attacked us, but also because, you know, FDR was a smart guy, we got into that second war. And after the second time it happened, we said, you know, our isolationism is not useful because we get dragged in anyway, so let's just be proactive on this shit and not do that. And so we are now Pax Americana. We have established an American peace that has created one of the most peaceful times in this world that has existed in human history from 1945 until now. We have put our hands in every pie because, you know, if we don't have control on what's happening and some shit happens that we're not gonna like and won't be able to control. And only when it gets really bad for us are we gonna go, oh shit, we gotta fucking come out of Fortress America and deal with it again. So that's the thing, you know, that's the thing. You think you can just fucking put your head in the sand and let the Russians, you know, conquer and rape the Ukrainians and they're gonna just do that and be like, oh, da, we are very happy we took Ukraine. We take nothing else. I don't know what accent that is, but I hope it's Russian. They're not doing that. They're not gonna do that, you know? Because once a fucking a guy like Putin and a people like the Russians, you know, get a little piece of something, they're gonna want another little piece of something. We already saw it happen. That's what the Russians do. And I will talk exactly that way about them until they stop living up to the stereotype. What they do is they drink and they conquer. You know, apparently. So, You know, I'm saying opposing the Ukraine aid is just stupid with no upside in it. You cannot... I have never heard a convincing argument for this. Is it more the Europeans' problem than ours? Yes, of course it is. But the Europeans are a feckless people who don't deal with their own problems. So we have to deal with it. Is it fair? Of course it's not fair that we have to deal with somebody else's problem. But the world isn't fair. Whatever gave you an idea it's a fair world here? Of course it's not. You know, but the Europeans won't do it. What else is new? So we have to. You know, I mean, it's not fair. It's not fair. Of course it's not fair. But that doesn't matter. Nothing's fair. What's fair? What's fair in this world? I was born blind, for God's sakes. When I was 18, my mother had a couple drinks and went to go walk down her staircase and tripped and broke her own back and lived the next 12 years as a paraplegic. The world is not a fair place. Don't think that it is. And if you think it is and want to act that way, it's only going to bite you in the ass because you being stupid is going to result in stupid shit happening. It's like, you know, the Germans have a crappy army. And even 2 years after Russia invaded Ukraine, guess what? Their army still sucks because the Germans are dumb. I know that's an oversimplification, but, you know, I can't go on another 20-minute side rant. Anyway, so listen, you know, of course the French aren't doing enough, but, you know, who thinks they would? So we need to do it because other people won't. It's why we end up having to do a bunch of shit that we shouldn't have to do. Shit in one hand, should in the other, see which fills up first. Like, you know, so you people are going to say, oh, we shouldn't help Ukraine because X, Y, and Z. And then Ukraine gets eaten up by Russia, the Russians take Moldova, and start fucking pushing it Poland. That's what's going to happen. And like, look, I hope I'm wrong and it doesn't happen. I hope I'm wrong and maybe the Ukrainians... Jesus Christ, sorry. Maybe the Russians would just take Ukraine and say, hey, we took Ukraine, that's all we want, we're done. I mean, that would be one thing. I wouldn't really like it, but if I thought that was going to be that way, hey, maybe we should just let them swing. Because fuck it, right? Who cares? Right? We're just that morally bankrupt now. But like, look, if I knew for a fact it was going to stop there, I might, be open to the argument that we don't help them anymore because the Europeans won't. You know, I wouldn't really dig it. I would still want to help them, but I would understand that as an argument. But only a moron would make that argument. So if it's not that argument, I don't know what the argument is. Is the argument that we're going to wait 4 years and fight a stronger Russia or something? Because that's stupid, you know? Let's stop them now while we can. Let's just stop them right now. I don't see why we wouldn't do that. It's insane to me that we would not do that. But, like, there's a big faction in the country, Donald Trump's faction, that is thinking that we just don't have to deal with it. I don't know what the hell they're thinking. I don't know if they're thinking at all. Honestly, like, you know, here's my problem. Look, like, I don't know. I've never really understood why people like Trump. I don't get it. I want to talk to my buddy Pete about it again, too. I don't get it. I mean, I think some people don't know better, but I certainly don't want to be a jerk and say that most people backing Trump don't know better. I'm sure most people know exactly what's going on. And backed Trump anyway, you know. I mean, I would say at least half the people who vote for Trump have, in their own minds, solid reasons for voting for him. Whether it's taxes, or Russia, or Ukraine, or illegal immigration, or abortion, or transgender people, or, you know, how much money we should be giving out in foreign aid, or, I'm trying to think of other stuff that's important. You know, how much money we should spend on, oh, I don't know, fixing our roads and bridges or our schools or, like, what we should teach in school or shouldn't teach in school or whatever. I'm not saying these people are right. I'm saying these people have reasons in their own heads for why they support this guy. I get that. But it also looks like somehow Trump has just kind of captured some people on an emotional level. And if he says he's for X or Y or Z, they're like, Trump's for it, I'm for it. That's all I need to know. Which is stupid. I don't get that. I don't get that weird kind of thing of like, we're just going to follow the leader. I don't do that. I mean, I look at it like this. I'm glad when Joe Biden agrees with me. If I don't agree with Joe Biden on something, I don't agree with him on it. I you vote for the person who agrees with you most, understanding that they will do some things you disagree with. For example, Joe Biden is too soft on illegal immigration. and illegal immigrants. It's crazy. He should have kept that border shut like a nun's cunt. And I don't know why he didn't do it. But he didn't. But you know what? Joe Biden's still the best president in the last 60 years. Because he's done things I agree with. Many things. I didn't agree with the way Joe Biden got us out of Afghanistan. It was kind of a shit show. You know, we had the Taliban providing us security at Kabul Airport. You want to know how much of a shit show it was. Like, I mean, it's insane. We should have had the entire city of Kabul as our leaving staging ground. And we should have pulled out another 300,000 refugees out of that country. Anybody we could have gotten out who wanted to leave, I would have pulled them out. Even if we didn't bring them to our country, we could have dropped them off in, oh, I don't know, Canada. Or, you know, the Dutch could have taken some more refugees or wherever the fuck. But look, Biden fucked that up. I disagreed with that. I don't like how he handled it. Any moron who reads the New York Times should have known that the Taliban were going to take over in less than a year when the Americans left. The CIA guys were telling Joe Biden that shitty government we built had a year and a half to last before the Taliban took it. What a dumb fucking take that was. But the point is, that's just the thing I disagree with Joe Biden on. I'm not going to be like, well, I like your shitty Afghanistan withdrawal because, you know, I voted for you and I'm going to vote for you again. Nah, fuck that. And the president fucking took an L on that. Like, there's other stuff I disagree with Biden on. Oh, yeah, like, his failure to, like, do whatever he can to make marijuana way more okay federally. Like, he's anti-marijuana as a Democrat. He's not as anti as he could be. But his anti-marijuana stance is stupid. Politically stupid and morally stupid and fucking practically stupid, too. But he's an old man, you know, probably saw Reefer Madness or whatever, you know. But I don't, like, my opinion on that doesn't change because I'm going to vote for Joe Biden again. Or, sorry, I don't vote. I mean, if I ever did vote, that's who I vote for. But, like, my opinion doesn't change because I back Joe Biden. It won't. But I feel like some Trump people are like, oh, Trump is for this, so am I. It's stupid, don't do that. You know, you got to examine issues critically and then you know, vote for the people who agree with you most. Like, you know, a good leader might make an argument to me that I didn't think about and convince me of something. But like, you know, that's a different thing. Then they convince me. But I don't know what argument Trump made in order that you think not supporting Ukraine against Russia is a good idea. Fuck the Russians, man. The Russians suck. I don't give a fuck Vladimir Putin rides around with no shirt on a horse. Who cares? It's just theatrics. It's stupid. You know? It's like if you want to fucking live in a conservative Christian place that hates gay people, move to Alabama. You don't have to fucking back the Russians. I don't know why anyone ever would in this country. They are our historical enemy for a reason. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's disappointing to me that the Republicans don't even do the shit I want them to do. I mean, like, they might have 1,000 flaws, but at least they used to hate our enemies, right? You know, and now they don't even do that right anymore. It's pathetic. It's really, really bothersome to me. You know, I could continue for a long time. I don't know. Oh, you know what? Okay, so I will end the podcast this way. I've had ChatGPT craft me 8 questions. I know I've done this before. So I've had ChatGPT craft me 8 questions to answer. I haven't seen them yet, and I asked for some non-current event questions, like, because I've just been talking about Russia and Ukraine. One or two things. I really hate when my podcast sounds acoustically unprofessional. It really bugs the shit out of me. I just want to mention two things, sorry. First of all, you're going to hear echoes because the room I'm going to enter is big. Sorry, it is 3 things. You're going to hear a ticking clock. It goes tick every second. That, you'll have to hear that bothers me. You're going to have to hear the whir of a laptop fan, and also that bothers me. I apologize in advance, but I recognize that I am just nuts on this, and people put out plenty of podcasts that sound less professional than mine, miraculously enough. So, I mean, if you'll bear with me on those 3 things, here we go. I'm going to walk. I'm a walking. Welcome to the blind spot, everybody. I'm a walking. Here we go. Just walking through a slight obstacle course. I have shit everywhere. Here we go. Here we go, everybody. I'm walking down some steps. Oh, yeah. How interesting. Sorry, I bumped into something. I am blind. It's a hazard of fucking being so. pretty much priced it in until it ruins my podcast. Anyway, here we are. Let's see now. The hell? Alexa up two. Sorry, Alexa up two. I hear such loud. I'd rather have you hear music than like echoes and fans and shit. So here we go. Let me, oh yeah, sorry. That's great. Super fucking professional. Thanks everybody. Welcome to, okay. Let me just, see. Let me just see here. I'm gonna try and. I'm going to answer these questions for you. I just didn't want to end the podcast so abruptly. I didn't want to just confine it to a rant on one thing. I apologize for all the things like dead air and all that shit. All right. Okay, here's the first question. What is the nature of consciousness? And can it ever be replicated by artificial means? I mean, fuck. Can it ever be fully understood or replicated by artificial means? So yes, it probably can be fully understood, but not by me. And not now. We barely know what it is now. I'm not even going to hazard a guess. Yes, I am. It's my guess is that it's an emergent capability of the structure of the human brain. My hope is that, like, you know, there's a ghost in the machine and we have souls, but that's stupid, you know. But that's what I would hope it was. But it's probably just, like, a wonderful byproduct of us having the brains we have. You know, like dogs and gorillas are somewhat conscious too, apparently, and dolphins and stuff. Can it ever be replicated by artificial means? Oh yeah, definitely. If it's done in nature, if it's doable in nature, like, it's definitely doable in an artificial way. I mean, like, you know, soon we'll be able to replicate a bear artificially. I mean, yes. The answer is yes, 100%. Is free will an illusion, and are our choices predetermined by a combination of biology, environment, and societal influences? No. I think free will exists, although it's not a thing I can prove. This is actually a long-standing argument with a guy that I have with a buddy of mine who won't come on this podcast, whether or not free will exists. I think free will does exist. I mean, I just haven't been convinced that it doesn't. I also will admit that I absolutely want to believe it exists. Like, that's important as well. I absolutely want to believe in free will. That doesn't mean it does exist. But, you know, I think it would be sort of an empty life to be like, hey, you know, I think it would be empty to, like, look at life and go, like, this episode of The Blind Spot is brought to you by a combination of biological, societal, and environmental factors, and I had nothing to do with it. You know, it would just make the world, to know that there was no free will make the world hugely depressing to me. I also don't see evidence that there is no free will. I'm not convinced by that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff we don't know yet. Like, we don't know what consciousness is or really how it works. We're starting to figure stuff out. But, I mean, we don't know enough that I feel like I have to answer that free will question in that free will doesn't exist. So I think free will exists and certainly hope it does. To be clear, like, you know, society and environment play a huge role and biology play a huge role in who people are and what they want and how they do things and what they want to do and, like, how they frame what they want. Like, you know, I mean, like, the people of Afghanistan aren't genetically evil, but, like, if you grow up in a Taliban situation, you're more likely to be, like, sympathetic or part of the Taliban. It's not like they're genetically fucking programmed to beat their wives and fucking be douchebags and fuck goats, you know? It's just that that's what their society is, and when you're raised in it, you become that thing. It's like, you know, look at slavery. It's like slavery existed because, you know,
Your dad had slaves. You were 4 years old. You saw slaves. Your dad died when you're 20. You still have slaves. You know, everybody around you is, it's like, it's a whole thing. A slave society, I mean. You know, and it perpetuates itself as all societies do until something happens where it stops happening. Like, you know, if you think that, like, the reason that you are against slavery is because you're a fucking super moral person, I mean, maybe you are, but you've also been taught from birth to be against slavery, and so you are. But let's move on to the next one. Can true altruism exist? Can true altruism exist? Or are all acts of kindness ultimately self-serving? I don't care. I just don't care. I mean, like, look, it's like, the argument is pretty simple. It's like, look, you know, you give $50 to a homeless person, but that also makes you feel good because you've done a kind thing. So that means, like, that act is not fully altruistic because you got something out of it too. I don't care. The homeless guy still got his $50. I don't really care. I don't care. I don't care what you think about it. Good. I hope it does make you feel good. You might as well get something out of wasting that money. The guy's gonna go buy crack with it. You know, so I don't care because the acts of kindness still happen. Now, I mean, I know that in my own life I have tried to do things because I thought they were kind. But I know also that I would like to be a kind person sometimes. So, like, I guess that's a self-serving component. Although, it's complicated because I think, like, you don't get extra points for being a moral person, you know? Like, doing a kind thing doesn't mean it's going to come back to you. Often, like, doing a kind thing is difficult, you know? He's dead now, so I can say this. Like, I had a buddy named Ernest who was a crackhead. And he would come to me like, yo, Jay, give me 20 bucks. Because he wanted crack. I mean, he would tell me that's why he wanted it, you know? I'll pay you back. He was definitely not going to pay me back, you know? I'll clean your house. Like, I didn't want my house cleaned or didn't need it cleaned or, like, whatever. What I most wanted was to keep the 20 bucks. But, you know, he's my buddy. Guy wants to smoke some crack. Every once in a while, I'd give him money for crack. And, like, if I got paid, I would want my money back sometimes and sometimes not, depending on how I felt. But, like, you know, I was trying to do a kind thing. But I was also helping a friend, and, like, everything is always complicated by the nature of consciousness and subconsciousness and, like, the how you think about yourself and stuff. So I'm going to just take a pass on that one and say, I don't know. No, I'm not taking a pass. I'm going to say probably not, but I don't care. Okay, let's see what the next one is. What does it mean to live a good life, and how do societal expectations shape our pursuit of happiness? Okay. Well, a lot. I mean, I was just talking about the Taliban. So if you're a young little Talib, maybe a good life is you have 6 wives and you keep them in the house and make sure they don't ever fucking become independent. And when they get uppity, you beat the shit out of them. And you have 30 kids and you memorize the Quran. And then you die committing an act of jihad. And by the values of certain societies, that's a good life. It's a great life. You know, maybe in a different country, you know, like, you're raised to be a little American or a little German, and you have 1 wife and 3 kids, and you attempt to make those children flourish, and, like, you know, you have a fulfilling career, and so does your wife, and you guys are in deep wedded bliss, and then you die. And that's a good life, you know. So part of it depends on the society you're in, because the society you're in is like the framing device of how you consider a lot of stuff. I mean, many people go against strong tenets of their society, but it takes a lot. It takes a lot for people to, like, step out of what their society says and to do things that society doesn't dig. As the late, great Octavia Butler says, society will chew you up and spit out your bones, you know? And she's right. And, like, I know you're like, well, I do this little thing that's a societal rebellion. I know you do, but it's not like a big one, it's a little one, probably. You know, you wear a fucking, a pink shirt, and it's like, pink isn't cool for you to wear in that society. It's a little thing. You're not like in America going, I think slavery should be brought back. I want slavery legalized. That's a big one, you know? So I'm saying rebelling against the tenets of your society, the big ones, it's difficult. So naturally that shapes the good life. You know, that shapes your conception of the good life, because, like, your culture and your society and your environment are putting, like, for lack of a better word, they're putting memes into your head that shape how you think about stuff. And, like, that'll shape what you think is good and bad. And, like, even when you kind of go off on your own and start to reformulate how you think, like that societal shit is still pounded pretty deep in your brain. So society shapes it a lot. Your pursuit of happiness, which is the good life. I mean, even whether pursuing happiness is the good life, is a societal aspect. Like the Romans didn't think you being happy was what the good life was. They believed in duty to the state, and they weren't totally wrong. But, you know, so it's shaped it hugely. I mean, what do I think the good life is? I think a good life is being true to yourself and, like, trying not to hurt other people for evil reasons. I mean, like, you know, beating a man and robbing him because you're broke and you would like a car and he has money is wrong. So, you know, the car would make you happy, but beating the guy up is so wrong that it's not worth the car. Or, like, the car is tainted or whatever. It's like, you know, like living a good life without beating other people up to go get their money so you can pursue your good life is, you know, what I'm saying. I mean, I'm saying be true to yourself, live by your convictions, be kind and loving to your friends and family if you love, to your friends and into your family if they're good to you, you know. Like, be a good person. I don't know, it's a complicated question. I mean, living the good life, I mean, I love when people are doing the things they want. I like when people do the things that make them happy. It's like, I like to find out that there's a guy who likes to carve little dogs made of wood and that he spent the last 60 years doing those and selling those and making a good living, that he has 3 kids or no kids, but he's happy. You know, I like hearing about that stuff. I like people to be themselves and to just be happy. I want that for everybody. You know? So it's complicated. I guess it's complicated, but I guess I'm done with that one too because I could just ramble for hours. I got to pull the plug at some time when I don't know if I'm making any sense anymore. So here's the next one. Is the search for objective truth futile in a world governed by subjective experiences? No, it isn't. Michael Jordan scored X amount of 3 free throws in X season of his career with the Bulls. That's an objective truth. The sun is this hot. That's an objective truth, you know. Walnuts contain X amount of protein and X amount of fat. That's another objective truth. We haven't found every objective truth yet, and subjectivity is a thing that exists, you know. So objective facts exist, but so do subjective feelings or, like, interpretations of facts, but no. Objective truth is an entirely possible goal to achieve. It won't give you every answer, though, because, for example, like, whether or not the United States should accept huge amounts of illegal immigration and just try and say, fuck it, and integrate those people into our society, or whether the United States should say, like, we don't want all these illegal immigrants, we're going to deport 80% of them and send them home. Like, that is not a question that objective truth can answer because it involves subjective opinions. So there's that. Let's go on to the next one. We're almost done. This is number 6. There are 2 more after this. How does language shape our understanding of reality, and can we ever understand the world without linguistic constructs? Language shapes our reality a lot. I don't know how much a specific language, like if you only know English versus only knowing French, I'm not sure how much that shapes our reality. I would assume it does a little bit. I assume it does a little bit, but, I got distracted trying to decide if my buddy was going to be annoyed if I made a couple eggs and some ramen and used some sriracha sauce, and then I was thinking, am I going to mess this kitchen up if I do that, because that's not worth it, and I was, like, having a whole conversation with him in my head about it. I'm sorry, that was bad form. Let me reorient here. Okay, right, so I don't know how much the difference between knowing French and Japanese as your only language shapes your understanding of reality, but I'm going to say a little bit. Is it possible to understand the world without any language? Yeah, I mean, and, like, it'll be increasingly possible as technology gets better, but, like, language is a hugely important thing, and people without it don't do well. They lack understanding of a lot of stuff, because linguistics is a super useful way. I can say there is something kind of like a podcast, but not exactly like one, and you can have some concept in your head of what I might be talking about. I could say, I could say, Language is it's too complicated. I mean, but I could say there is a vehicle a lot like an airplane, but not exactly like one. It's a hydrofoil. So like, I can say it's half plane and half boat. And without language, that concept is difficult, if not impossible, to get across to somebody. Even if they see it, they might not even have the words in their head to conceptualize things properly. So currently, language is essential to understanding reality, and non-linguistic things are a supplemental to it, in my opinion. I would also say that being blind, I think my view is, no pun intended, but colored by my lack of vision, because vision is not linguistic. But you still name the things you see. So I don't know. But anyway, moving on to the next question. In an increasingly digital world, In an increasingly digital world, what defines our identity, and how do virtual interactions define our sense of self? I feel like I've talked about this before on the show. But I think that, like, it's a weird thing because a lot of people spend a lot of time online. They, like, spend a lot of time on Facebook or Reddit or TikTok or Threads or X, formerly known as Twitter. And they spend so much time in these online spaces that they start to see the online conversation as the real world. I know it happens to me. I'll be on Reddit, and I'll be, like, reading comments on a thread, usually political or news shit, because that's what I'm into. And I'll be like, what the fuck are these people talking about? And then, like, I'll go outside and realize that, like, I never encounter the Reddit opinion in real life, or at least, like, not very often. But I've gotten all jazzed up. You know, I'll read these 300 comments about how we shouldn't help Ukraine and fight off a Russian invasion. And I'll be like, these motherfucking people on Reddit. And I'll be like, nah. Get all angry, you know what I'm saying? And then I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? This isn't real. Like, this is just a little echo chamber on the internet that I'm in for some reason. You know? But I think people start doing that a lot. Like, my God, I feel horrible for the people who are on, like, TikTok for, like, 3 hours a day just pumping that shit into their brain. Because it gives you a false conception of the world. But I also think, like, it's also, look how people, like, stunt and flex on Instagram and stuff. That has to be, like, what you'd call a, like, you're forging an identity in a digital space. You know, like, you're like, hey, I am a world traveler. Here are my pictures on Instagram. Or, like, I love making lasagnas. Here's me at the real lasagna chef. And like that, and you're posting all these videos, or you're like a big Taylor Swift fan, and you have that on your profile pics, or whatever, or your fucking, I don't know, I don't use social media much, but like, you know, your username is Taylor Swift fan 74, and like, you know, all the background shit on your profile is Taylor Swift. That's you showing markers of identity online. So clearly, the internet shapes identity now for some people, especially those who indulge in it a lot. I don't know how exactly that relates to, like, who you are in real life as well. It's a very complicated thing. I am increasingly drawing the conclusion that social media is a net negative for society in general. It doesn't have to be like that. I mean, there are people who use many social media platforms in a constructive way. So, like, people who want to complain, oh, X is bad because of X, Y, and Z. It fosters this and it fosters that. It's like, listen, that's how many people use that platform, but that's not how they have to use it. Back when X was Twitter and had just come out in maybe 2010, I'm always interested in new shit. So I made myself a Twitter account, and I followed all the news sources I liked. I followed the New York Times, and the BBC, and CNN, and MSNBC, and ABC, and CBS, and The Atlantic, and The New Yorker, and Reuters, or is it Reuters? Whatever. Reuters, and the Associated Press, and NPR, and the Wall Street Journal, you know, and many others. And, like, so it was cool, because what I had was this real-time news feed, so I didn't have to click on any news sources. I would just go to my Twitter and, like, go scroll through the most recent tweets, and I would know what was going on. I mean, I like the stock market, so I'd follow CNBC, you know, and Market Watch and stuff, and what I got was this great aggregated feed of all my news. And it was cool. Like, I didn't fucking sit there and get into some stupid argument with somebody on Twitter for 4 days, because I'm not a moron like that. You know, I mean, like, you know, So a lot of this stuff I'm saying is about like how you use shit. It's like, look, you know, if you're going to sit there and use YouTube to like self-radicalize because you're just watching dumb videos and the algorithm gives you more dumb videos and you keep watching them, that's not really a YouTube problem. That's a you problem. If you're on TikTok and you're making 90 billion TikTok videos and that's your identity, it's like, again, that's a you thing. You know, you've chosen to use the platform that way. Go ahead. But like, you know, I don't think it's good for people. But like, that's on them. That's on them. Like, you know, stop doing it. Stop doing it. I deleted my Facebook like 10 years ago. I'm so happy I did it. Like, I'm not on TikTok. I'm not on any of these. I'm not on any social media platforms. I've gotten rid of Reddit too. I just suspect that it's unhelpful. And like, you know, so my point here is like, in a digital age, which we're clearly in, and it's only accelerating, it's only accelerating. Parts of our identities now are going to be shaped digitally because we're in digital realms. You know, but that doesn't mean that, like, the way it's happening now is good. It isn't. It's probably bad. I think it's warping. I think people allow themselves to warp themselves. It's a very weird thing. I don't know how to explain it fully. But, like, you know, you just sit there and you watch a bunch of videos about how communism is right. And it's been 4 years. You fucking, your beard is down to your chest and you're still watching those videos. And now you're a super crazy communist. Because you just sat there and let that algorithm just, like, fucking shove shit up your ass. You shouldn't have done that. You know? And, like, then you make it worse because you're part of this weird bubble now. And now you're, like, a component in this ideology. And, like, you are now creating content that's radical because you've been radicalized. And, like, this doesn't just apply to news stuff. This applies to everything where this kind of shit applies. Taylor Swift fan, Taliban member, you know, Republican, Trump Republican, you know, fucking Bernie Sanders Democrat, NASCAR fan, you know, whatever. Like this shit just escalates. And people use the tools they have now badly. And we can certainly talk about reshaping the tools, but we also got to talk about why people are so fucking weak. But that's a subject for another show. Let's go on to the next question. Is perpetual peace among humans achievable, or is perpetual conflict part of human nature? I don't know. I would certainly like to think that peace, that permanent long-term peace is achievable. But I'm not sure. I mean, like, look, you know, we've been in a very peaceful 75 years. The 75 years of peace we've experienced from 1945, and it's probably also not 75 years, I'm bad at math. The 75 years of peace we've experienced since 1945, up until now, even with the Ukraine war and stuff, and even with that war Israel's fighting against Hamas, we're still in an incredibly peaceful era in human history. More peaceful, say, than a random point at any point in time before. So, certainly, like, less violent times are possible. We know because we've experienced them. I think, in theory, we can get to a much less violent time, but people are also monkeys and not always rational and find reasons to fight. So I really don't know. I would hope perpetual peace is possible. I hope we find an era of long, long peace where there is no war, swords into plowshares, and all that. But, like, whether that happens, I have no idea. And on that semi-pessimistic note, I'm going to end this episode of The Blind Spot. If you stayed with me the whole time, thanks so much for listening, and I'll catch you next time. Peace out, bitches.